From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, struggling schools try to stay open by working with the state to boost student test scores, but it is a heavy lift.
If you add 2 years of skills, within a 6 month period, most people are going to say, well, that's terrific. But when you take the state exam, you're still going to be behind.
The growing epidemic of hepatitis A in Southeast Michigan. Public health officials push to vaccinate food workers.
Food workers handle other people's food, and so it's just the nature of their work. It's not that they are more prone to getting an infection.
Navigating the perils of reporting sexual harassment at work.
Coming forward and complaining about being sexually harassed by your boss can result in a career changer for you.
Plus, artificial intelligence coming for white-collar jobs. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Southeast Michigan is in the throes of a major outbreak of hepatitis A. The State Health Department reports 583 cases and 20 deaths in Southeast Michigan since August 2016. And at least a dozen restaurants in Southeast Michigan have been affected, which is putting a special focus on food workers. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith is here with us now. Lindsay, we know there is a limited supply of the Hep A vaccine. Why are food workers a priority for being vaccinated right now?
Seeing these notices that it's happening, and this is a disease that is transmitted, it's called via the fecal-oral route. Basically, the disease sheds and is spread in poop. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not really good about washing your hands, or if you touch something before you wash your hands, that can live on the surface for months. And so food workers handle other people's food. And so it's just the nature of their work. It's not that they are more prone to getting an infection.
State law requires food workers, all right, if you have a hepatitis A diagnosis or symptoms, you have to tell your employer, and then what?
You have to tell your employer. Your employer has to tell the health department. The health department, then you're not required to shut down, but you are required to do a whole disinfection procedure. And then the employee can return to work after a week or so after the symptoms come on. But there's no state law that says that you have to tell the public if there was an infection at, say, McDonald's in your neighborhood.
Now, that's surprising. I think a lot of people just went, say what?
It was surprising to me, too, that that wasn't required. But I think that there is a balancing act here. It definitely can and does hurt businesses that have been affected by this. And the thing is, too, the way the virus works, you're really the most highly infectious before you have symptoms. So once the food worker comes down with it, once we already know that it's happening, they're not spreading it anymore. So it doesn't really do any good to say, put a bad name on this particular business. What is important is that you know when that person was highly infectious and you're able to get the public notice to people that were in that restaurant during that period of time, which could have been a month ago.
And the chances of that, especially if you're talking some fast food restaurant with so many people in and out, good luck.
That's where they put out the public notice. And most of the health departments, I should say, that I talk to say that they have always put these out and that businesses are working with them.
Now, as you tell us in your story, Oakland County is hosting a couple vaccination clinics for restaurant workers this week. And now we know why they're at priority target. Who else is deemed high risk?
The state is suggesting homeless people, people who abuse substances, drug users, people that have underlying liver problems, because it's really a liver disease, food workers, men who have sex with men. But I would also suggest inmates, people who are incarcerated, healthcare workers, people who might be exposed to hepatitis A when they come in to the doctor. Another one that I've seen in studies is childcare workers, people that work with kids, because kids generally don't show symptoms if they catch it. So they can kind of be one of these spreaders. And we know, I don't know, I have a 3-year-old. They're very bad at washing their hands and wiping and all that kind of stuff. So,
and I know the vaccine's in two doses, but the public health folks just want people to at least make sure they get in for that first one.
It is very important to help curb the outbreak, because having just one dose can curb an infection for years. So if you haven't been able to get that second dose or whatever, don't let that scare you. Oh, I have to go get two doses. Just go get one. Most healthcare plans will cover it. Even if it doesn't, it's $36-ish, somewhere around there.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith. As always, thanks, Lindsay.
Not a problem.
What is happening with the state's poorest performing schools? The upcoming holiday break kind of marks the halfway point in this school year, which is especially important for 37 Michigan schools fighting for their lives. They were put on the state's closure list last spring after years of poor test scores. But they've entered into a partnership with the state, kind of an intensive care unit for troubled schools. And approximately 40 schools will likely join that partnership based on their 2017 test scores. Chalkbeat Detroit reporter Aaron Einhorn recently visited a Detroit elementary and middle school threatened with closure last spring, and she's with us now via Skype. Aaron, remind us once again, just what did it take for those endangered schools to remain open this school year? What terms and conditions did the state lay down?
As you may recall, the state had identified 38 schools for the closure list because they had been at the bottom of state rankings in the bottom 5% for 3 years in a row. And the state was planning to close down every school unless there were extenuating circumstances, such as no other school that kids could attend. And there was strong political opposition. There were lawsuits filed by several school districts. And, you know, Governor Snyder, instead of going forward with that, decided to partner with the State Department of Ed and to create an alternative that was called the partnership model. And they became partnership schools, where the districts and the schools would partner with universities, intermediate school districts, other organizations that could potentially help them. And they were given targets that they had to meet. And it was different targets for each school, kind of based on each school district had a different partnership agreement. And there's certain targets that they need to meet within 18 months, certain targets that they need to meet within 36 months. And if they are unable to meet that target, there could be other consequences for the schools down the road.
And those consequences, it's clear from your story, are kind of unclear.
For sure. The partnership agreement leave it to the district to determine what to do. So if the targets aren't met, and some of those targets have to do with improvement, so schools need to show improvement over time. Some of them have to do with the MSTEP, the state standardized exam. They have to, you know, go from, say, 3% passing the test to 5 or 6 or 7% passing the test. And schools that don't make the grade aren't able to do that, the district would then be asked to impose some kind of change, which could be the school shut down, could be the staff replaced. Districts have the option to turn schools into charters. But I should also add that the partnership agreement isn't state law, and it's something that Governor Snyder has embraced as an alternative to closing schools. But a new governor is going to be elected next year, and a new governor could have a different plan. So even if a school is in the partnership agreement, it could still be closed down by the next governor.
Now, you told this story through the eyes of the principal at Bethune Elementary Middle School in Detroit, Principal Alessandra Woods, who really, she put it out there for you. She said, we've got sixth graders at a third grade level. What are the two big tasks that have to be met and quickly?
Well, so that's what's really interesting about kind of what happens at schools that are struggling is that if you're at a third grade level, the school's going to work on bringing you up to the fourth grade level and to the fifth grade level. But when it comes time to take the MSTEP, if you're in the sixth grade, you're going to get the sixth grade test. So even if a child improves dramatically from the third grade level to the fifth grade level, if you add 2 years of skills, you know, within a 6 month period, most people are going to say, well, that's terrific. But when you take the state exam, you're still going to be behind. So what schools like this, what makes it really difficult to do school turnaround is this idea that you have to do both things at the same time. So you got to get the tutors in there and small group instruction and one-on-one instruction to really help the kids catch up on things that they missed out on last year for some reason or the year before. And at the same time, you have to teach them what they need to learn this year. So you might have to learn how to multiply whole numbers and fractions at the same time in order to make sure that you're learning grade level skills now while also catching up on the stuff that maybe because of excessive absences or maybe your family moved a lot or maybe you had an illness or you had some other kind of major disruption in your life that caused you not to succeed in third grade or fourth grade or fifth grade. You're in the sixth grade now. You've got to learn all of that stuff at once. And that's really can be quite difficult for schools to be able to do both of those things at the same time.
It seems this is like a top-down and bottom-up challenge, a kind of a catch-22, it seems. How does Principal Woods like her chances
of succeeding, of accomplishing these two big goals?
Well, she's got a lot of hope. And, you know, I guess you have to be in that job and to come to work every day and do that. But, you know, she's focused on instruction. You know, principals in Detroit don't necessarily have a lot of control over who comes to teach in their schools because there's a teacher shortage. So to some extent, you know, you're sort of just really scrambling to try to fill every classroom. But then once that teacher is there, you know, she goes and she observes the classroom and she looks for opportunities. They're doing a reading comprehension lesson and, you know, maybe is what they're reading rigorous enough? So she suggested to one teacher, maybe use a passage from last year's MSTEP instead of another article. To another teacher who was having students give oral presentations in class, she said, well, have them do some writing too, because the test is going to be looking for writing. So can we include more writing in the classroom? Can we include more math, you know, in the social studies curriculum? You take what you have. And she's got lots of tutors. There's a city year program, which is recent college grads. Just get lots of time, focus on the instruction, focus on the academic deficits, and really just kind of do as much as you can for these kids as quickly as you can.
And this story's been repeated all over, you know, when we're thinking about the schools threatened last spring with closure, and then we've got 40 or so more that will likely be added to the partnership program based on their 2017 test scores. Now, are these schools getting substantial help from the state, or is the state kind of just standing there in the background with arms crossed and foot tapping, watching what the principals and teachers are doing?
I think it's different in different districts. The partnership program doesn't have any extra funding for schools. The state has been assigning liaisons to work with the schools to kind of better help them navigate existing programs, existing grants, existing supports to make sure that the schools are maximizing the level of support that they're getting. In the city of Detroit, it's complicated by the fact that close to half of the schools are now in the program. And so there's a new superintendent who's kind of ramping up support for all of the schools in the district. These schools, he says, the partnership schools might get some new supports like student mental health programs a little bit sooner, but it's not like they're, you know, these are the schools that need the most help, so they're going to get some more money. That's not a possibility at this time.
Erin Einhorn, Chalk Peak, Detroit. Great talking with you, Erin. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, what to do if you experience sexual harassment on your job. That's in 20 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Americans are disillusioned, disappointed with Congress. The rock-bottom approval ratings confirm that. With that in mind, what would you think about a candidate who promises to return or donate to charity any campaign contributions from sources that taint that candidate's integrity, who refuses to do anything to attack the character of his or her opponent, and if who elected promises to sit down with someone from the opposing party at least once a month and to sponsor at least one bipartisan bill every year? In other words, someone who will put principles before politics. A new political group called With Honor believes there are candidates who can do that, veterans. Military vet Peter Meyer is on the board of this new cross-partisan political group. He's the grandson of the late Fred Meyer, and of course the Meyer name is on over 200 stores. Peter Meyer, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
What is the problem that you are hoping to solve with this group, With Honor?
I think the main problem we're looking to address is the increasing political polarization in the country, and, you know, it doesn't take very long to figure out and point to a number of news stories that would have been much easier to solve a few decades ago when our legislators worked. And now we're hoping to bring more veterans into Congress with a can-do attitude and a willingness to reach across the aisle to help our country work again.
You are a vet. You did a tour of duty in Iraq. So tell us, as somebody who's been through it, why could vets in office change the political climate in this country?
Well, for one thing, veterans share one unique trait that really only people who've forcibly served on jury duty have, and that's having to work together with a team of folks who are unlike you, come from different backgrounds, different experiences, but are united with a sense of purpose and sharing the same mission. And it's, I think, that sense of mission focus that's really been lost in Congress, and that I think veterans can bring more to the table if we increase their participation.
How do you want to have With Honor do that? What will be some of the action steps?
So our main step will be supporting around a dozen to two dozen candidates in the 2018 congressional elections for the House. a lot of times in the early stages of an election, especially in the primary, narrow interests will win out and pull candidates to the extreme. We want to be a force to help candidates stay true to their principles so that they don't have to go chasing endorsements on the fringes, but can feel secure in surviving that primary so that they're there for the general.
It's certainly no secret it takes a load of money to run for Congress, and most vets don't have deep pockets. So that's where With Honor can step in with money to help elect these next generation veterans?
Absolutely, especially next generation veterans who are relatively new to politics, don't have deep party connections. They're at a serious disadvantage, and more so than in previous years. You know, the cost of many things has gone up exponentially in this country, from education to healthcare, but the cost of funding and financing a congressional election has outstripped all.
What kind of pot of money have you been able to pull together already through With Honor?
Well, we're aiming to raise $30 million for the 2018 congressional cycle, and that could filter down to around $1 million per candidate. And our goal is to evenly distribute that across both Republican and Democrat races, and then also keeping an eye open for independents. So we're truly a cross-partisan organization and seeking to make a meaningful difference in the elections in which we're engaged.
And I can tell you're focusing, at least at this point, on running for Congress. Is there an idea that you could take this effort and open it up to state and local political offices?
We're just starting out. This is a new startup organization. We would love to see our organization grow and expand over the years, but for 2018, our focus is on making a meaningful difference in Congress, and then we'll go from there.
The With Honor website, Peter Meyer, serves up some interesting observations about the percentage of veterans in Congress and public approval of Congress. Talk to us about how those are connected.
Absolutely. So partially due to the all-volunteer force and a number of other factors, but veteran participation in Congress has been declining steadily from a high in the immediate post-World War II generation of around 75% to lows around 20% today. And this is coming as we've seen a lot of dissolution of trust in our institutions. And while we can't make a direct causation, the correlation there is pretty clear. If you have folks in office that you don't trust have the nation's best interests in their hearts and that aren't willing to put the country above their party, then you're going to see a decline as well in faith in that institution.
Those promises that I listed at the beginning of our conversation are part of something called the Pledge. Talk to us about the Pledge.
You know, there are a lot of other political organizations that have pledges, you know, don't raise taxes or support this piece of legislation or that. Our pledge is really just a return to civility and decency. You know, we want to codify what folks should already be doing, what some are already doing, but we believe should be the standard, and reward those who don't go chasing after pots of money that, you know, they wouldn't be willing to claim as their own. They can't turn a blind eye to financial contributions from folks they don't purport to support, and they also shouldn't be engaged or allow others to do so, engaged in negative campaigning or other actions. So if a candidate's running and attack ads are being aired by an outside group, it's that candidate's responsibility to denounce them, and if not, it'll be presumed that they support it. So it's really just trying to bring back that sense of civility that we've been rapidly losing.
And then I was very struck with the once elected, if you get into office, you will sit down and meet with someone once a month from an opposing party. We don't see a lot of that these days.
And oftentimes, the way some of the political financing goes, bipartisanship and compromise are viewed as negatives and are punished. So we're trying to be, again, a bulwark against those more extreme forces in the political system to make sure that people aren't penalized for doing what they already should be doing.
You're really talking about a group of people when you talk about these veterans. As I saw, the observation was made on the With Honor website, that oath is not just for the period when you're in active duty. That oath is for a lifetime.
And that oath is something that I hope all veterans kind of keep in their heart. And it's that we want to have members of Congress aspire to return to that sense of placing the mission first, a place in the country first, and of, you know, subsuming any of those partisan ambitions before the whole.
What is With Honor's call to action, first to veterans who might be listening and also to voters?
Our call to action to veterans who might be listening is look us up, get engaged. If you're thinking about running for Congress, understand that there are others out there looking to support you that maybe aren't immediately apparent, you know, that there are more political organizations out there than just the party apparatuses themselves. And to voters, I would hope that folks have a chance to check out our website at withhonor.org, read the pledge. As we begin to announce candidates in the coming months, maybe look up somebody who's not on your side of the aisle and figure out if their values might align closer to you than you thought, to really just do what we ask of congressmen as well, and that's to put the country ahead of party.
Peter Meyer on the board of With Honor and a veteran himself. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Peter.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Think for a moment about your most deeply held beliefs. Can you remember when you first formed them? Has it been so long that it feels like they've just always been there? Research done by my next guest suggests our beliefs may change for better or for worse without our even noticing. And that is being reflected in public opinions that have shifted since Donald Trump launched his campaign for president. Michael Wolff is here now. He's a memory and learning researcher at Grand Valley State University and recently published the results of an intriguing experiment where he looked into how we change our beliefs. Michael Wolff, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
What was the question or observation that you wanted to test through your experiment, Michael?
My colleague Todd Williams and I were interested in what happens when people change their beliefs about contentious topics, whether people seem to be aware of changes in beliefs when they happen or if they seem to be relatively unaware of changes in their beliefs.
When you say contentious topics, such as?
We have studied social science topics mostly, so questions such as the extent to which television violence causes you to actually be violent, the extent to which spanking is an effective means of discipline. We've just started new experiments on the effectiveness of gun control and reducing gun violence. So questions where there may be evidence on either side of an issue. It's an important characteristic of our research that there are people with beliefs on both sides of the issue. In the experiment we just published, we looked at spanking effectiveness as a topic. One of the reasons that that works for our purposes is that some people believe spanking is effective, others believe the opposite.
Michael, how did you construct this experiment?
In the first part of the experiment, we had people report their beliefs about a variety of topics. The topic we were interested in was spanking effectiveness. So people reported their beliefs about the effectiveness of spanking on a scale, whether they think spanking is effective or ineffective. A couple of months after this, we had people come into the lab for the actual experiment. Everybody read a text that described evidence about spanking effectiveness, either suggesting that spanking was effective or that it was not. After reading, people reported their beliefs about spanking effectiveness again. Then the critical part of the experiment was people tried to remember what belief they had reported on the questionnaire that they filled out a couple of months earlier. There were two main findings in the study. First was that when people read evidence that was inconsistent with the belief they had initially reported, people did tend to change their beliefs. This did not tend to be wholesale change from one belief to its opposite. Rather, people tended to move from one end of the scale towards the middle. The other effect was that when people tried to remember the belief they had reported earlier, we found a large memory error that people tended to make, in which their memory for their previous belief was much more similar to their current belief than it was to their actual previous belief. So people seem to be acting as if their current beliefs have always been their beliefs. And this is what led us to interpret the results as people being relatively unaware that their beliefs had in fact changed.
So my view may have shifted, but I don't think it did because I don't really remember how I felt before it shifted.
That's right. In order to understand that your view has shifted, you would need to be aware that your old view is different than your current view, and we found that people do not seem to be aware that their old views and their current views are different.
So, Michael, it seems that when we remember something, it's not just like clicking on a Word file on our laptops and opening it up and reading it. What do you think would be a more accurate analogy to when we remember something?
Our results are consistent with a lot of other research on memory that leads to the conclusion that memory is a constructive process, that when we try to remember information, we don't tend to remember it as if we're opening a file on the computer where the information is exactly as we typed it months ago. Rather, when we try to remember information, things that are currently available or aware to us at the time we try to remember things seem to have a strong influence on what we create as our memories. In the case of our experiment, we think that your current belief about an issue has a strong biasing effect on your construction of your memory from the past. And so that current belief is part of what drives your memory of what you used to believe.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking to Michael Wolff, who's a memory and learning researcher at Grand Valley State University, as we talk about his experiment looking into the way we change our mind on a subject that even if we change our mind, we may have a hard time recalling that we ever felt another way. So with that as a kind of a framework, Michael, there was a recent article by Brian Resnick in Fox that talked about your study. And it tracked the beliefs of Republican voters about Vladimir Putin. And just to recap, in 2015, before Donald Trump began running for president, only 12% of Republicans held a favorable view of Russia's president. This is according to a Gallup survey. Now, here we are in 2017, that has jumped up to 32% of Republicans who say they like Putin. And the variable one has to feel is Donald Trump on the campaign trail and in the White House. How does this square with your research? What's going on here?
This squares with our research in that it would suggest that people who change their belief, in this case about Vladimir Putin, may be unaware that their beliefs have changed. In that poll, they don't ask people, did you support Vladimir Putin a few years ago? But if you asked a question like that, you may find that people would say, yes, I've always supported Vladimir Putin. I should mention also that our results are not specific to any political party. These are general conclusions about memory, so they would likely apply equally across the political spectrum.
Certainly.
But they do suggest that when people's opinions change about things like Vladimir Putin, that people may not be aware that those changes have taken place.
So not so much being hypocritical, just honestly not realizing that they've shifted.
That's right. It is quite possible that people appear hypocritical, but are not actually being hypocritical. Often, when people report their opinions on polls like this, there isn't any documentation of what they used to believe. So most of the time, it would be the case that you would have no way of checking if you wanted to know whether your opinions have changed or not. So that would increase the chances that you don't feel that you're being hypocritical, or nobody would say that you're being hypocritical because nobody knows that you used to believe something different.
They don't realize that their views were once different.
Yes, that they may not realize that they used to, for example, read what we would consider mainstream media sources and consider that to be credible information.
What should political pollsters take away from your research, do you think?
That if you want to get accurate information on people's opinions or on their beliefs, you should stick to questions about how people feel or what they believe right now. So if you ask people your opinion about political leaders or issues, people could tell you how they feel at a particular moment. What you should stay away from are questions about whether their opinions have changed. For example, do you feel differently about the president now than you did before the election? Do you think the economy is better than it was a year ago? Those kinds of questions are ones in which you may get inaccurate answers, and not because people are being hypocritical or trying to deceive you, but rather because they just may not remember accurately how they used to feel.
Is there anything, do you think, we could do as a people just to kind of be more self-aware? I guess not have collective amnesia and not be manipulated by anyone.
One possibility, and we have some correlational evidence about this, even though in general people seem to show this memory error in which they're not very well aware of changes in their beliefs, it's always true that some people seem to be more aware than others of these changes. If people are aware that their beliefs change, they may be more open to reading new information or information that they don't agree with. You might imagine a case in which someone says, well, what's the point of reading this particular news source or this particular columnist? I know I'm not going to agree with this information, and I know I'm not going to change my mind, so I should just stay away from this information completely. And people may be mistaken in that their beliefs are more likely to change than they realize. hopefully we could get to a point in which we have a better understanding of how to get people to meaningfully engage with information that they don't agree with. Society would benefit in general if people on all sides of the political spectrum would be willing to meaningfully engage with ideas that they don't agree with or with data that might be contrary to their opinions. It's difficult to get people to really grapple with information that they don't agree with. Our research, I think, presents one piece of this puzzle that perhaps one of the reasons people are reluctant to engage with information they don't agree with is that they just think they're not going to change their mind. So perhaps making people more aware of this will help. We need more research to figure that out, though.
More work to be done. Michael Wolfe, memory and learning researcher at Grand Valley State University. His latest research can be found in the Quarterly Journal of Experimental Psychology. Thanks for your time, Michael.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Up next, just who among us should be most worried about the fast-improving capabilities of artificial intelligence? We'll find out after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
Advances in computer technology are one of the many factors that have led to the decline of certain types of jobs. But to some extent, technology has always played a role in changing how we work and live. Think of the internal combustion engine or factory mechanization. Today's guest on The Next Idea, though, is wondering if advances in artificial intelligence could be a tipping point into societal unrest, even revolt, because of loss of jobs. Dr. Kentaro Toyama is the W.K. Kellogg Associate Professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we have already seen declines in some types of employment because of automation in the U.S., bank tellers, travel agents, assembly jobs. You wrote a piece for theconversation.com, though, where you argue the advances in artificial intelligence will soon replace another tier of jobs. What kind of jobs are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm mostly thinking of kind of white-collar professional jobs, jobs that, you know, we are used to thinking of as requiring a good education and that really need to be done by human beings. So there are jobs like certain kinds of legal work, you know, writing contracts, or jobs like financial analysis, where investment banks require a lot of analysis of the day's news and how that might affect their investments, and of course even journalism. So increasingly, there are technologies that write certain kinds of news articles on their own.
So you're talking about the very students that could be sitting before you in class.
Absolutely, yes. I certainly have students whose jobs, 10, 20 years out, might no longer exist.
Okay, that does jolt you. And we kind of think, maybe take comfort as computers and AI have been developing. Well, they can't do important things that a human can do, have feelings or emotions or express creativity. And the machines need humans to drive all this, but you're saying not so much anymore?
Well, I think, this has been a philosophical debate for some time, which is what are the limits of what computers can do? Some things, arguably computers will never do, like actually experience the emotions. But increasingly, we're finding that the kind of cognitive side, the processing side of what we consider human intelligence, almost all of it can be done by computer. And I personally believe that, unless you believe in supernatural forces, even within human beings, that there's no reason why anything that you can think couldn't ultimately be done by computer.
So if white-collar workers, these kind of jobs you were describing, were suddenly without jobs, if these jobs go away, what do you think might happen to American society?
I think you'll see more and more of what we're already seeing, which is a kind of prolonged crisis about the way people feel about the economy. Right now we already have a pretty high rate of unemployment, but imagine that extends, not just to people who have blue-collar skills, but to the white-collar workforce. That's a significant percentage of the population.
And that unemployment has tended to be in the service and blue-collar areas. Why haven't we been concerned about the disappearance of those
jobs?
Well,
we should be, and I think, some people are. But it doesn't, it's not not quite as many of the people that we would like to be convinced. And I think one of the reasons is that people who tend to hold those jobs have much less influence, political influence. They're less connected to wealthy people. They're less able to organize and articulate exactly what the issues are. You know, in the past, we've had trade unions and so on that did a good job, I think, of expressing those issues. But even those are now going away. And so as a result, there's not a strong voice that is really arguing for their needs.
You know, in your piece for TheConversation.com, I found it interesting. You used the example of the Luddites in 19th century England. And just to remind everybody back from history class, they protested against industrialization, didn't they?
They did, and they were very quickly put down as a rebellion.
How?
Basically, it was exactly the people who, you know, owned the factories and who benefited from industrialization, who oftentimes were members of the government itself, and in any case had sufficiently close ties with the government, that the government actually invested quite a bit of effort, in some cases military effort, to keep these rebellions down. And eventually, you know, industrialization forged on. And, you know, the Luddites are history. They're not a strong presence anymore.
So if we saw this kind of unrest pushback from white-collar professionals, do you think they would be more successful than the Luddites?
That is the question. I personally think yes, because arguably these are exactly the people who are best connected to, you know, all kinds of powerful positions. Our politicians have brothers and sisters and daughters and sons who are from these ranks. I kind of think of it a little bit like, you know, when we saw the shift in Congress from being pro marriage for same-sex couples. You know, a lot of the stories we heard about, oh, well, you know, I don't really believe this, but I have a daughter who's lesbian, or I have a brother who's gay, and I now understand that point of view. Imagine if that same thing happened about joblessness. And I would say so far we haven't seen that much because exactly the elite who tend to hold power don't have brothers and sisters and relatives and friends who are in that situation. But as those numbers rise, I think we'll see more and more.
Start hitting closer to home.
I think that's right.
On a personal level. You see this as a political challenge, not a technological challenge. Talk about that.
Yeah, ultimately, I think technologies amplify underlying human forces. So even, you know, today, in today's discussion about fake news and political polarization, you know, I think social media has a role, but it's a role that is basically amplifying what is already happening in our society. Similarly, with unemployment and joblessness, you know, there's no reason why the same technologies that potentially put us out of work couldn't be put to use in a way that everybody benefits. But that's not the way our current social economic system is built. And so unless we're willing to change that underlying system, which is a human decision, the technology will probably just keep amplifying the inequality that is currently there.
So you're kind of talking about that 1%.
Yes, the 1% and increasingly the 0.1% and so on. And even the 10%, of which, you know, many of us who normally don't think of us ourselves as being in the 1% are members of.
If AI, then, is poised to cause mass unemployment, possible rebellion, as you put it, turning nearly everyone into possibly displaced workers, is there anything we can do about this in advance?
That's a good question. I mean, there's certainly lots of things we could do in advance. I think most of the things we could do in advance are, again, political in nature. They're about, you know, regulating industries that are extremely powerful and that these days influence billions of lives. They're about, you know, thinking about what is really a fair way to tax individuals. You know, things that seem like bread and butter political issues. If we fix those, then I think, interestingly, the technology automatically kind of ends up working in the favor of the same political changes we're trying to cause. On the other hand, no amount of, you know, technological development itself undoes those political things. And so unless we're focused on the politics and the social changes, the technology won't align.
These things you describe don't sound real likely in today's political environment.
Exactly. That's right.
Regulating businesses and powerful forces that are beyond average people.
Yes, I think that's true for now. But hopefully, you know, we'll come to our senses and possibly find other ways to achieve those ends. You know, one thing that, you know, we live in a democracy, so this is not a permanent situation. And so, you know, if we see that things are going in the wrong direction, hopefully as a society we'll change that.
Dr. Kentaro Toyama teaches at the University of Michigan School of Information. His article for TheConversation.com is called "Will the AI Jobs Revolution Bring About Human Revolt Too?" Thank you so much for talking with us on The Next Idea.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Several of the women who've accused President Trump of sexual assault and harassment held a news conference today, the first time that they've appeared together. All have accused the president of groping, fondling, forcing kisses on them, and they're calling on Congress to investigate these claims. They're coming forward at a time when a series of women have accused high-profile men in entertainment, journalism, and politics of sexual assault, the Me Too movement. All of this casts a bright light on a very old problem. But there are many working women who can't rely on the media or congressional investigators to hold their harassers accountable or make it stop. So for anyone who feels that they've been harassed at work, the question becomes, how do I go about reporting this problem? What steps do I take? With us now is Royal Oak attorney Carrie McGee, whose firm specializes in civil and unemployment rights. In the 2 months since the Harvey Weinstein story broke, Carrie, have you had an uptick in the number of people calling to say, I believe I've been harassed, now what?
Well, interestingly, I think that that's not occurred. And I would say that it is because the fear of reporting sexual harassment in the workplace still exists. The culture still exists where women don't feel as though they will be protected, and so they're not empowered to complain. And so while we have received more calls from women seeking advice, which is very important to get advice on how to deal with situations because office dynamics are very important to understand, women are still very reluctant to complain. Sexual harassment is almost always about power. The victim is typically in a situation where the sexual harasser has authority over her. And so coming forward and complaining about being sexually harassed by your boss can result in a career changer for you. And I think that's why you're seeing that these women have come forward after years, because they're out of that environment now and they feel more empowered to disclose what happened to them. But while in that environment, they felt that they weren't going to get protected and that their careers would be adversely affected as a result.
Now, we have heard the stories, you know, about Weinstein, about Matt Lauer, about Charlie Rose, on and on. Give us an idea of some of the things you have heard from clients through the years. What are some examples of the kind of behavior that truly was sexual harassment?
Well, for example, you hear about women being called into their boss's office and the door being closed, and it being just the woman and the boss, and the boss either engaging in inappropriate sexual comments, sexual propositioning, or in some instances, sexual touching. And the woman feeling as though she can't do anything about it. She feels completely terrified, and she feels as though if she objects to it or tells him that this is not appropriate, you can't talk to me that way, that when she leaves that room, because it's just been between her and her boss, that her career is going to be adversely affected, and if she goes and complains about it, that she's either not going to be believed or the boss is going to be considered more valuable than she is, and so she's going to be perceived as a troublemaker, and her complaint is not going to result in a substantiated finding, and then her career is going to be adversely affected.
So, Carrie, let's say that I'm that person. What do I do next? What are the do's and don'ts?
In a perfect world, if you tell the sexual harasser that it's not welcome and it continues, then most companies have internal policies dealing with sexual harassment, and you would want to follow the policies and complain to the proper department, typically the human resource department. I think it's very important for women to make sure they journal incidents that occur, keep a journal at home in terms of the date that the incident occurred, what happened, if there were any witnesses, in a very factual way, so that you have some kind of documentation if the sexual harassment continues.
Do I tell family and friends? Because it seems in a lot of these cases, reporters have been able to go and confirm the story with friends and family and maybe other coworkers.
Right. No, that is very important, because it's more likely that what the person is saying is true if contemporaneous with the incident they've told somebody, a coworker, they told a family member. And always this impacts the person emotionally. And so it's important for them to get some some assistance in that regard as well. But typically people who come to me at a point where the environment has become totally intolerable and they've either felt forced to resign or become psychiatrically disabled.
How does someone decide whether to go to state or federal agency, such as the EEOC or a Fair Employment Practices Agency, or go straight to an attorney like you?
Well, I think, first of all, if a woman is feeling that she's being sexually harassed in the workplace, it's really important for her to get some good counsel on how to deal with it. And so the first step would be to get legal counsel and to talk to that person, a professional who specializes in this area, about what's happening and the dynamics of the work environment so those can be taken into consideration, and also so that the woman has some power behind her, too, with legal counsel, and she doesn't feel like she's out there on her own. And in situations where the complaints have been brought to the company's attention and appropriate remedial action hasn't been taken, then the next step would be go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency charged with the responsibility of investigating these charges. But more importantly than that, they also are a required administrative step before you can sue. So you have to go to the EEOC under the Federal Civil Rights Act before you can file suit.
What are the statutes of limitation?
The statute of limitations for a federal claim, you must file within 300 days in Michigan, within 300 days of the date of the adverse employment action. And so you would want to file within 300 days of the sexual harassing event to be protected from your claim being barred. That's to file with EEOC. Under the State Civil Rights Act, there is no administrative requirement, and you can go directly to court, and you have to file within 3 years of the adverse employment action. And to be safe would be 3 years of the incident of sexual harassment.
And if we're talking about someone who is, you know, not making a lot of money in her job, is doing all she can just to cover her bills, and the idea of incurring legal costs is just beyond the pale, is there help for women in this arena as far as getting some assistance in paying legal costs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I recently represented a woman who was a low-level salesperson working on commissions, and she was being severely sexually harassed by the owner of the company. And he knew how vulnerable she was because she was living paycheck to paycheck, and that's what made her such an appealing victim to him, because he knew she would feel powerless. But we handle cases on a contingency fee basis. We understand that people aren't in a situation to pay hourly for the work, and so our fee is conditioned on getting a result, and so there's no out-of-pocket expenses that the individual would have to pay for legal services in that situation.
Carrie, do you feel like we really are in a moment of history that will leave profound and lasting changes in our workplaces?
Yeah, I really hope so, and I think that this is a game changer, because I think all of these complaints are demonstrating how pervasive the problem has been, how the culture has been in all different industries, all different professions for so many years, and that hopefully with this information, employers will change the culture for the women to make them feel protected so that they can complain and will value them as much as they value the higher-ups, the CEOs and so forth. I think you've seen some cultural changes at the lower levels with the companies, with coworker on coworker sexual harassment, where that's been taken as a zero tolerance and the employee has been dealt with. But I don't think that culture has changed when you're dealing with the power struggle, the power difference. And I'm hoping that with these complaints and the recognition that it's a pervasive problem and the recognition by sexual harassers that this is not going to be tolerated anymore, it's not going to be accepted, it's not going to be swept under the rug, that will change behavior.
Carrie McGee with the Royal Oak Law Firm, Pitt, McGee, Palmer, and Rivers. Carrie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.